Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're going to be looking at two of the more controversial nominations Donald Trump has made to be members of his cabinet. One is Secretary of Education and the other is Treasury Secretary. And we're going to start with Secretary of Education. A U.S. Senate committee has postponed its vote for Secretary of Education nominee Betsy DeVos to give members more time to review an ethics report outlining steps that she will take to avoid conflicts of interest. The committee vote was originally scheduled for tomorrow. It's now scheduled for January 31st at 10 o'clock in the morning. And we have a lot to talk about. This has been a very contentious hearing for her. First of all, a lot of the senators were concerned that they only got one round of questioning at 5 minutes per senator for her confirmation hearing last week. They wanted more time to press her on her views on education and also her qualifications. This hour, we're going to talk about that appointment. I know that many of you are very interested in education. She is a big private school voucher charter school proponent, doesn't have very much many ties to public education in the state of Michigan, but she is a big proponent of the charter schools and private voucher schools. And that has made some people concerned. Others think that that might be the way to go to improve education for everybody in the country. But it's created a bit of a debate. So join the debate if you'd like during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our guest is Dustin Hornbeck. He is a student, PhD student in educational leadership and policy at Miami University. He taught history and government for 9 years in several high schools in Ohio, and he was the teachers union president for 4 years in schools there. Prior to teaching, he worked in the Ohio State Legislature and briefly for the Auditor of State. Our phone number for you to join this conversation about Betsy DeVos is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Hello, Dustin.
Hi there. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us. Let's find out a little bit more about her. This woman has a whole lot of money, doesn't she? I mean, a whole lot of money. She's a billionaire?
She is a billionaire with a B, absolutely. She actually came from a wealthy family. Her father was in the auto industry, and then she married Dick DeVos, who is heir to the Amway fortune. And so combined, they have upwards of $10 billion estimated in their as their fortune.
$10 billion.
Yes, that's what I've read.
Wow. How many schools could you build for that? You could build a lot of schools, couldn't you?
Well, you could. And the funny thing is that when she was asked about a decade ago as to whether or not or why she just didn't use her money to build schools that supported the agenda that she believed in, she said that there just wasn't enough money for a for one person to be able to make the difference that she wanted to make.
Ooh. I don't know, $10 billion could go for a long way, I would think, Dustin.
Yeah, I could think of a few things to do with $10 billion in education.
Most of the criticism has come from people who are public school proponents who say that she has absolutely no connection to public school. She never went to a public school. She didn't send her children to a public school. She's never taught in a public school. So how could she be in charge of the Department of Education, which is overseeing well, we'll find out how much it's overseeing. Mostly the public schools that people attend in this country, it's something like 80%, isn't it?
Well, 85%, and that number does swing a little bit from time to time, but 85% of our students attend public schools, and there's, I think, around 7% that go to charter schools, and the rest are in private and parochial. And it's kind of interesting because I think that it goes beyond just the K-12 education population that is concerned about this. I think that it goes to also the higher education as well and people who are involved in financial aid and understand that the Department of Education deals with billions of dollars every year and giving out FAFSA and federal aid to students and loans. And that is actually a huge part of the job of Secretary of Education. So it goes far beyond just the K-12 spectrum. But I understand why people are concerned in the K-12 arena as well. Mm-hmm. But yes, you are right. Yeah.
And how much money has she spent with the billions that she and her husband have? How much has she spent to promote the candidacy of people like our governor, Governor Scott Walker, who is also a big proponent of private voucher schools and charter schools as well? Has a lot of her money gone to support such candidates?
Absolutely. It's estimated that she spent around $17 million since 1981 just on political donations. Between her and her husband. So she spent, every year she spends hundreds of thousands of dollars for candidates. It's kind of interesting because 10 of the 12 Republican members of the committee that's hosting the hearings for the Secretary of Education, she gave donations to. And yeah, she spent a tremendous amount of money trying to marshal funds toward the support of the choice agenda. If you were to ask what she was interested in with regard to education, I would say that it was choice, 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 school vouchers, and choice.
Mm. When she was asked about certain parts of federal law, like the students who have disabilities, she didn't seem to have much familiarity with something that's a crucial part of public education, making sure everybody has access.
Yeah, when Senator Kaine asked her a question about the IDEA Act, which is for individuals with disabilities and students with special needs, and he asked if she planned on making sure that that was implemented in all schools, she said that she thought it should be left up to the states. And he questioned her on that because that is a federal law that's required for every school in the United States. But it's kind of interesting because a lot of times charter schools and private schools don't offer the services that are mandated by IDEA, and so certain students could be kind of turned away from those schools that are mandatory in public schools. And so that's why some of the senators are concerned, or people in public education, because if you start a charter school and you don't want to service some of those students, sometimes the numbers get skewed in testing, and they're not represented correctly.
Tell me about the federal government's role in the education of children in this country. Do they have a big role, or is it mostly left up to the states?
Well, it is. It's mostly left up to the states. If you've taken a look at the Constitution, there's nothing in the Constitution about education specifically. Prior to the Constitution, the Northwest Ordinance provided federal control of education, but otherwise the 10th Amendment provides that every state should take care of their own education themselves because it wasn't mentioned in the Constitution. And so the Federal Department of Education was created in the Carter administration, and every year it has kind of grown in power, but that influence and that power that the Federal Education Department has can be through a bully pulpit, it can be through offering grant programs like Secretary Arne Duncan did with Race to the Top,
right,
which makes a kind of a competitive model, but a big part is civil rights and making sure that the disability students with disabilities get representation, and states depend on the federal money.
Mm-hmm. And the whole No Child Left Behind as well. It seems as though the federal government has become, at least with what their policies are and how they may reward some districts more than others, has become more prominent in the last couple of administrations, hasn't it?
Without a doubt. And just last year, there's a new law called the Every Student Succeeds Act that takes the place of No Child Left Behind. And this law specifically punts back some of the power that was given to the federal government by the No Child Left Behind Act to states. So to say that there's no direct power, a lot of direct power in the Federal Education Department would be true. However, there's other ways by which the Education Department and the Secretary of Education can influence ed policy within the United States.
Mm-hmm. You write in a piece that caught our attention, and I didn't know that this was true. Every education secretary you write to date either went to public school or had children that attended public school. She would be the first in the 35-year existence of the role of education secretary who has no familiarity with public schools.
None at all. She said in her hearings that she tutored. I don't really know, and nobody really knows exactly what that meant. But she went to a Christian high school herself. She's from Holland, Michigan, which is kind of like a town that was centered around Reformed theology. And she also went to a college called Calvin College, which is named after John Calvin, which also adheres to that Reformed theology, and she subscribes to that. And so her children also went to religious schools, and she's donated thousands of dollars to religious schools and religious colleges, and she's had no familiarity or direct work within public schools or in any sort of administrative capacity. Her capacity within education has been specifically through advocacy, through lobby, and through the donation of funds.
Why do you think Donald Trump picked her?
That's a billion-dollar question, right? I think that if you take a look at Trump's track record through this year, it has been to kind of put people in positions that shake things up. And Donald Trump, during the campaign, went after teachers unions multiple times. In his inauguration speech, he said that we have an education system that keeps students from learning all knowledge.
Yes.
So he's coming at it from this perspective that our public schools are failures. And I disagree with that personally, and a lot of other people do. But he thinks that they're failures, and he believes that choice is the best cure for this failure. And so he has proposed $20 billion in the federal budget to support a choice agenda. And Betsy DeVos is one of the leading advocates for choice in the country.
Hmm. Well, it seems to be almost at odds with his kind of, on other issues, populist message, isn't it? I mean, public schools are, if anything, the great equalizer.
Oh, I agree completely. I would say this. Early 1980s, this report was released called The Nation at Risk, and it basically said that American schools were falling behind the rest of the world. And so it kind of caused a panic among schools, and so they started implementing these accountability measures. And this is how we get to these testing periods and some of these ideas of school choice and vouchers. And so the idea of school choice comes from the Milton Friedman camp. And so when people, I would say that, and many people would agree with me, that school choice is a capitalistic, market-based way of looking at schooling, whereas people from a democratic perspective would say that it's democratic way of looking at it. See, you can elect school board members. If you don't like the school, you get involved in your community, because many people believe that schools are direct reflections of their community, and that charter schools and private schools take that voice away from the community. So there's kind of two camps there, that thought of market-based and the thought of democratic-based.
And tell me about these for-profit schools. I've read that there are quite a few of them. They're for-profit charter schools, for-profit private schools. How extensive are they in Michigan, and what's their record of success?
Well, they're absolutely they're popping up all over, and in Michigan and Ohio and Pennsylvania, what they're called is education management organizations. So if a school district or somebody wants to start a school district, a charter school, what they do is they usually find a sponsoring organization, and they're supposed to be nonprofit. But once they get the school going, they can hire out their management services through outside companies, and these management services can come in and actually run the school, and they can make money off of the tax dollars that are being spent. Hundreds of million dollars are being spent towards these education management organizations. So one big study that was done came from the Credo Institute at Stanford University. What they did was they studied the Detroit charter schools that DeVos's money helped fund through some of her advocacy organizations like GLEP, the Great Lakes Education Project. And they said that charter schools may have performed slightly better than the public schools, but a year-long study done by the Detroit Free Press basically said that they were abysmally failing, and that the accountability system that was used was lacking, and that there's no real way to know how well the schools in Detroit did.
Hmm. Let's go to some phone calls for you. We're talking about Betsy DeVos, Donald Trump's nominee for education secretary. It's been put on hold on the confirmation, actually the vote, until next week, because she had some papers that had not quite been filled out, so they're looking at ethical issues with her, and so the vote has been postponed until next Tuesday, a week from tomorrow at 10 a.m. 800-486-8655. Knowing her political philosophy, her full educational philosophy, do you think that she would make a good secretary of the Department of Education in this country? What do you think? 800-486-8655. Paul in Menominee Falls. Hi.
Hi, thanks for the program. Great guest. My answer to your question is I do not think she will. I think maybe your guest knows about this. In the late 90s, the Republicans and the Democrats in Michigan had gotten together with the support of educators and parents, and they drafted legislation that would make more accountability for charter schools, and they were about to vote on it. It was right before an election. And Betsy DeVos came in, pumped a lot of money into it, and the Republicans changed their mind on this. And your guest had mentioned, and maybe you had mentioned, the amount of money that the federal government is looking at spending, or Trump is looking at spending. But my research tells me that there's 50 million children that are serviced by public schools across the United States, 5 million by private, and with a total expenditure of $600 billion. So I think there's vast amounts of money. I support a lot of different choices, and I worked in charter schools and private schools and public schools, and I just see a lot of great things happening across the spectrum. But I think that behind it all has to be accountability, and I think that where I have seen the best results is where there's accountability. And she wants to shield the public from that accountability. That's what her track record has been, and it's unfortunate that she has been his pick. Thanks for the great show.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. Dustin.
Yeah, I think you're right. There was a time in the early 2000s where DeVos supported this movement to give school vouchers to all kinds of students in Michigan, and she spent a lot of money on it, and it went down. It also should be mentioned that last year when the Every Student Succeeds Act passed, that President Obama signed into law last year, there was a movement for a moment by Senator Lamar Alexander to include funding for charters, but it died, and I don't know if that's likely to come back, and that's a real question as to what's going to happen in the future. We'll have to wait and see exactly what the budget dictates and what the what the Congress will allow, because I think this is controversial in some states, even with Republican control.
Thanks, Paul. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. I'm a little confused on a few things. As a Trump supporter, I'm finding it hard to understand the protesting because you had said earlier how they're protesting Trump's policies and his cabinet's policies, and a lot of concrete policy hasn't even been made yet. And also, if you look at the overall vote, it was more against the people kind of wanting to churn things up and get rid of the establishment.
Well, let's talk about Betsy DeVos, though, John.
And the Republicans. And so why would it be so surprising that Donald Trump wouldn't pick an establishment individual to run a cabinet that has been establishment all along? So you can't have things both ways, but I think everybody really wants the same thing, but we're almost being too stubborn to admit it.
Yeah, probably not with education. This is really, they're very different visions of how we should educate. What do you think of her, John? Do you like her, Betsy DeVos?
Well, I don't know her personally, okay? And you can look at everyone's track record. Everyone has a history, whether it's good or bad. The only thing that you can try to do is make sure that what the vetting and this process and procedure that they're going through, that you establish what you would like to see happen. Hopefully her goals and ideas will again either parallel or intersect at that time. But then there's, as the last caller said, that accountability.
Okay, thank you. Well, some of the people who were questioning her were really concerned that they didn't get enough time to find out what her vision really is, because it was only one round of questioning. I'm not sure why that happened, Dustin, but maybe people feel they don't have enough information about her.
Yeah, I think so, and I think it's troubling to some people when Senator Franken from Minnesota asked her whether she believed in a growth model for accountability or whether just kind of an achievement model. She wasn't sure what he meant and questioned him on that idea. It's very important for people to understand that the accountability movement relies a whole lot on student tests to determine whether or not a school is considered a good school. And many people just assume that these tests are good ways in which to measure how good schools are. And, you know, there's a lot of people who work in schools and work in different in urban schools and rural schools and poor schools that look at these tests as a bad indicator because DeVos has supported the idea of giving letter grades to school districts. And so what ends up happening and what we see throughout the country is that schools in upper middle class white neighborhoods get really good grades on their report card, and schools in urban inner city lower income areas get Fs. And so we're perpetuating this these assignments of these bad scores on students who are already at an uphill battle. And so, you know, that's a lot of people make that argument that that this school choice creates this taking of the best students out of public schools and leaving students who struggle behind. And that way we can and those public schools end up looking terrible in the communities.
Thanks, John, for your call. Karen in Lake Forest, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, I totally disagree. I have the degree that this gentleman is pursuing, and I'm going to speak in terms of the public school system. But a lot of the public school systems that are in the urban community, they've earned those F. I know I've worked there, and tons of money has been infiltrated to millions of dollars, and I'm thinking of a particular school district in Illinois. And the more money they put in, the worse the scores were. They went down. We have schools in Illinois that are being threatened to be taken over by the state, and the charter schools in those communities are exceeding the public schools. Now, I understand that all charter schools do not do well, just like all public schools are not good, and they're all not bad. But there are a considerable amount that are, and there are a lot of charter schools that have made a difference. Now, as a parent, we have to pay taxes, and if someone told you, well, your money has to go to paying for someone's cigarettes, you'd say no. So now a parent doesn't have a right to say, well, we want our dollars to go here to educate our children. They should have that right.
Dustin.
Yeah, well, the caller, I appreciate those comments, but the data shows through multiple studies from Stanford University, from Mathematica Research, that charter schools struggle nationwide as an aggregate. And the ones that succeed, they succeed at getting students to do well at state tests. And they implement these rigid disciplinary ways in which that they should operate, and they basically tell students that they have been raised wrong and that they need to act in certain ways to fit in with the rest of society. And some people disagree with that. Now, some people do agree with that, that think that they should, that those tests are good in, measurements of those skills. And but there's still a debate on that. And many people believe that public schools are good and are doing a great job in our country.
We'll take a couple more phone calls for you. We need to pause for a moment. We're talking about Betsy DeVos's nomination to be Secretary of Education. It's been a controversial nomination, controversial and very spirited hearing for Betsy DeVos. The vote on her nomination has been postponed until a week for tomorrow, so everybody can look at the ethics reports that were filled out. Dustin Hornbeck is a PhD student in educational leadership and policy at Miami University. He taught history and government for a number of years in several high schools in Ohio. He was also the teachers union president for 4 years. And before all of that, he worked in the Ohio State Legislature. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have time for a couple more phone calls. Roger in Monona. Hi, Roger.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just brief comments. I do support highly the public schools as an equalizer. One of my concerns is the issue of that private schools in particular, charters can be integrated with the public school system. But with private schools, all of them being able to deny access to disabled children and children with special needs, I'm also concerned with my tax money going to pay for private schools that are religious-oriented, I don't think that that's something that I would be very comfortable having my dollars go towards. My one other comment is, at the beginning, you had asked the question of why had Donald Trump selected Betsy DeVos? And your guest there said, well, that's a billion-dollar question. My mind, that's the billion-dollar answer. That's why he selected her and some of the other people. Hmm. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. Dustin, you want to respond?
Yeah, I'll just say that that is it's a concern of many, because if we all of a sudden start spending money from the federal government, giving billions of dollars to states for the choice agenda, there aren't enough schools right now outside of the traditional public schools to support those students. And the worry is that there'll be these flyby nights, you know, that form, and, you know, whether it's a church or just a building that people throw up, and we're not sure if they'll be able to support the needs of the students. And, education is a degree that people work, they go to school for, and so there are professionals in this field, and that's an important thing by many. So.
Mm-hmm. One more call. Thanks, Roger. Larry in Waukesha. Hi, Larry.
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Always looking for irony. I find it completely ironic that the head of all of the education is delayed because she didn't get her homework done on time.
Yeah, there was a problem with getting all those forms filled out. I guess if you have that much money, you've got a lot of forms to fill out. Dustin.
Yeah, no, of course. She, I haven't heard anybody who said that they seriously don't think that she will be confirmed. I know that after the confirmation hearings, there were a lot of, the nighttime comedy shows kind of were picking fun at her about some comments she made about the grizzly bears and stuff like that.
Yes, the guns, right. That was a strange comment, you must admit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. She was asked if she supported it, having schools as no gun zones, and she said that she doesn't think she could support that, because if a school in Wyoming needed a gun to ward off grizzly bears, that they should be able to have one. And but I think there are a lot of comments made by DeVos, whether it be her financial standings, her money given to the people in the committee, or whether it be about grizzly bears, that have given people some pause. But I do think, and most people that I've heard think, that she will be confirmed.
Mm. Well, we'll find out next week. Dustin, thank you very much. Good luck on all your studies that you're engaged in. It's great.
Thanks so much for having me. And by the way, I love your Lincoln buttons. I wrote my master's thesis on Abraham Lincoln, so I'm a huge Lincoln
fan. Did you really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'm wearing one right now, actually. Will you send me your thesis? I'd love to read it.
Absolutely. We'll do that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take care.
Do you know how to get a hold of me? You know how to do this.
Yeah, I'll figure it out.
Thank you. You're a PhD student. You'll figure it out.
I'll figure it out.
I'm sure. Thanks, Dustin, very much. Thanks. Dustin Hornbeck, a PhD student in educational leadership and policy at Miami University, talking about the Betsy DeVos nomination. There are many nominations, of course, but we've centered on the two that are most controversial. And interestingly, there are people who have a whole lot of money, and maybe that's one of the reasons that they are somewhat controversial, because it's hard to figure out where all the money is going and if it's influencing decisions either to be nominated or helping people who espouse your point of view on a certain issue. Another of the contentious hearings for Steven Mnuchin, who, as our guest has written, might have a shot at Treasury Secretary, but his Wall Street pedigree makes him the type that Donald Trump fans love to hate. Joining us now to talk about Mnuchin is Zachary Miter. He's been a reporter for Bloomberg News for a number of years, writes features for the news service for Bloomberg Business Week and Bloomberg Markets Magazine, also worked at the Providence Journal in Rhode Island, and wrote an in-depth profile of Steven Mnuchin for Bloomberg a few months back that caught our attention. We'll be welcoming phone calls about him as we carry on here. 800-486-8655 is our number. Zachary, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
So let's talk about his ties to Goldman Sachs. His Wall Street pedigree, maybe it goes beyond Goldman Sachs. What's his pedigree?
Sure. If you wanted to sort of invent in a laboratory like the ultimate Goldman Sachs Wall Street insider, you'd probably end up with something similar to Steven Mnuchin. And this is my co-writer, Max Abelson, who worked on the story with me last year. That was the way he saw it, and I think it's accurate. He wasn't just an employee of Goldman Sachs. His father was one of the most important partners at the firm for many years, and had a parking space in the basement, even though the Goldman did not have a parking garage. That just tells you what an important guy his father was. And so Steven Mnuchin worked at Goldman Sachs with his dad for 17 years, became a partner, and then went off to do many other things in the financial world. So that just kind of shows he has really made his bones on Wall Street at Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm. Some of the really contentious questioning came when he was asked if he in some way benefited from the foreclosure crisis in 2008. How was he involved? This gets a little bit convoluted. Tell us exactly what happened with him.
Sure. So he, in 2008, this is after he left Goldman Sachs. He was watching TV one day, and he saw people lining up around the block on TV to get their money out of a bank in California that was failing because of the financial crisis, the housing meltdown. And he said, I'm going to go buy that bank. And that's what he did. The bank failed. It was taken over by the government for about 9 months. And then the government tried and tried and tried to find someone to buy it, but banks wouldn't touch it. So finally, Mnuchin came along and was willing. He got a group of investors to buy this bank and kind of turn it around. And so one of the things that he ended up doing as part of that deal, this is a bank that was focused in Southern California. It's called IndyMac Bank, and he renamed it One West, was that it had thousands and thousands of mortgages that were delinquent, many of which were just had been terrible loans to begin with that he wasn't at all responsible for, but he had to kind of clean up the mess. So he did tens of thousands of foreclosures during the 6 years that he ran this bank called One West.
Mm. And some of those people testified, didn't they?
They actually weren't allowed to testify at the hearing.
They gave statements.
And so instead, the Democrats came up with a sort of shadow hearing the day before, where they brought in some folks to speak out, and folks who had been foreclosed on and whatnot. But it's important to note here that for the most part, Mnuchin his bank was only acting as a sort of intermediary. They didn't actually own the loans. They were working for other parties like Fannie Mae who had hired them to service the loans and foreclose if necessary. And so in a lot of cases, they were actually kind of required to carry out foreclosures. It wasn't really kind of up to them.
Yes.
That's really important to note. And then it's very difficult to know from his time there whether their foreclosure record was really any worse than any other banks. All banks, as you can imagine, that have done thousands of foreclosures, you're going to have some sad stories and some people who feel injured. It's hard to be able to sort of judge his record against, what Wells Fargo or J.P. Morgan was doing at the same time.
Mm. But if you're going in to buy a bank where people are taking their money out of, don't you think in the back of your mind, or wouldn't you have to be aware that maybe you would have to do some foreclosures?
Absolutely. And Steven Mnuchin, one thing I can tell you about him is he thinks about all these things ahead of time. He's a very methodical and risk, he's a person who judges risk, who spends a lot of time judging risk. And when he bid for this bank, that the mortgage servicing business, that's the one that's caused, so much trouble for him in this hearing, was a business that almost no one wanted to touch. Almost all the other bidders who bid on this bank refused to buy it. And part of the reason he succeeded, part of the reason he was able to get the winning bid on this bank was he was willing to buy the whole thing, including some parts that were controversial and augured a lot of headaches ahead for him.
Mm-hmm. When you read about who he's given money to, he's given a lot of money to Democrats. Now he's Donald Trump's pick for Treasury Secretary. He sort of reinforces this feeling that a lot of Americans had. Hillary was taking money from Goldman Sachs. They were buddies making these speeches for hundreds of thousands of dollars a shot. And then you've got Donald Trump, who's got a cabinet filled with Goldman Sachs people. Goldman Sachs is still front and center here, isn't it, from a lot of these people who have gone through the ranks at that place?
Sure. I mean, if you look at the current, you know, the incoming crop of officials in this administration, it is heavy with Goldman Sachs. It's not just Steven Mnuchin, who's obviously a partner there, but also Gary Cohn, the president of the firm, has an important role. You know, and there's about four or five others who are in the mix, who are Goldman Sachs alumni. Now, that's, you know, for Treasury Secretary, it's actually not all that surprising. There was both Clinton and Bush appointed a Goldman Sachs executive to be Treasury Secretary during their times. Mm-hmm. So it's not unprecedented, but Goldman continues to be a firm that kind of generates these people who go on to hold power in Washington, mm-hmm. which is really pretty remarkable.
And, Zachary, what about the offshore thing that's going on with Mnuchin?
Well, there were some folks in the hearing who expressed concern that he had some his hedge fund had offshore affiliates in places like the Cayman Islands. And that is the kind of thing that you tend to hear every time somebody comes up for a nomination and they have an investment in a hedge fund or something like that, because and I'm afraid it's a little less exciting than it might appear to be, because for people who run hedge funds, almost any U.S. hedge fund that has investors that are nonprofits like universities or pension funds, those investments are basically always made through an affiliate in the Cayman Islands or someplace like that. And the tax reasons for that is extremely, extremely convoluted and mind-numbing, but it's not... In and of itself, it's not a sign of some kind of shady behavior or tax evasion or anything like that.
Yeah. Is he a generous man? Does he give? Do we know?
I wouldn't say that, you know, we spent a lot of time with him last year, and I wouldn't say that philanthropy seemed to play a big role in his life. He's been, you know, very busy kind of making money. We estimate his net worth is over $600 million, and we haven't seen him, you know, he has given some money away, but we haven't seen a kind of, you know, really massive scale, which isn't uncommon for someone who's still kind of in their working years. A lot of times people wait till later to sort of give it away. He's given to the hospitals and the art museums and things like that a lot of his friends probably give to.
Why is it that not only Donald Trump, but also George W. Bush and Bill Clinton are going to Goldman Sachs? Why do these presidents think people at Goldman Sachs are able to run the Treasury Department better than anybody else?
I mean, it may be hard to generalize about all three of those decisions, but I think in Mnuchin's case, what we know of Trump's relationship with him, and they've known each other quite a long time, and Trump is extremely impressed with Mnuchin's business success. I mean, especially the deal that he did with this bank that he bought in 2009. We've heard a lot of people remark that Trump has expressed to them just admiration at how much money he made on that transaction. We estimate Mnuchin just personally took about $380 million away from that deal, almost all of which was profit. So it was an incredible success. It's the kind of deal that if you're a deal maker like Donald Trump, you can really understand and wrap your head around and admire being able to invent, you know, to pull off a transaction like that.
Hmm. Even though all kinds of people, even if he may not have been directly responsible, but also one of the outcomes of his making $380 million when things got better was that people had to foreclose. I mean, there are two stories here that are so dramatically different.
Yeah. I mean, Mnuchin's, you know, what he said at the hearing and he said elsewhere is that it would have been much worse if he hadn't bought the bank, right? Because these people would have been foreclosed on anyway, and he actually kept the bank going and preserved jobs and turned the thing around. But there's no doubt that this was not all roses for him. I mean, he had protesters show up at his house in I think 2011. You know, protesting about foreclosures, and he had one of the people, a foreclosure victim, who they actually brought all her furniture there. They were pretending they were going to actually move it.
Really?
Into his house. He has a $27 million mansion in Bel Air.
Wow.
So you're right. I mean, this was, you know, when you do a transaction like that, there's controversy. It's not all just the upside.
Yeah.
For sure.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. Zachary Miter is our guest, reporter for Bloomberg News, has been for since 2006, actually. And we're talking about the Steven Mnuchin nomination by Donald Trump for Treasury Secretary. Our number is 800-486-8655. Is it a good nomination? Do you look forward to his running the Treasury Department, which he probably will? Do you not think so? Why not? We welcome your calls. Cindy in Fox Cities. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Cindy.
Well, Donald Trump had said when he was before he was elected he was going to drain the swamp, but I really think he's turning the swamp into a cesspool.
Is it ironic that he's named somebody, well, not only the only billionaire, is this slapping in the face of people who thought he was going to drain the swamp, Zachary?
I mean, it is ironic, I think, in that he described several of his political opponents as being sort of wholly owned by Goldman Sachs, right? He made much about the fact that Hillary Clinton had given speeches there,
right,
and accepted money for those speeches, and he also made much of the fact that Ted Cruz, one of his primary opponents, his wife worked at Goldman Sachs, and they got a loan from Goldman Sachs, and he made so much noise about that these people were just kind of hopelessly compromised, and that it has struck a lot of people as odd that he would go to so many Goldman Sachs people to staff his cabinet. But in another way, it's a very Trumpian choice to pick Mnuchin and some of these other folks, because Trump is also saying, these government lifers in Washington have screwed everything up, and we're just going to bring in some smart people from the business world who maybe don't have any government experience. Mnuchin has no government experience, but they're successful business people, and we're going to bring them in and just kind of whip the country into shape. And so in a way, I think there's another way of looking at it where it's quite consistent with his pledge. The problem, of course, is that at the same time you bring in a lot of wealthy people, and Trump himself is very wealthy, there's all kinds of conflicts in terms of their business interests around the world, and their connections, their entanglements around the world. It's quite difficult to find a way to contain that quickly so that you can actually trust that they're going to be doing the public's work and not have any conflicts of interest.
Well, you're writing about business. What's your thought on this? Does it make sense to bring somebody from the business world who could manage the Treasury Department better than somebody who, say, was a top-notch, terrific intellectual economics professor at UCLA?
Right. My opinion is that it's probably pretty tough to generalize. There have probably been fantastic Treasury Secretaries who came from public service, and there's probably been fantastic ones who came from the business world. Clearly, for Mnuchin, he understands the basics of the financial world, right? He has a pretty successful long career in the world of finance. He knows what a Treasury bill is. He won't have to have someone explain that to him. So that's a plus. on the other hand, I think the concern you have when you have people from the business world who don't have really a demonstrated background in public service is you don't actually know, are they just going to see everything through the lens that they were seeing it as a private business person out for their own profit, or are they going to be able to broaden their horizons and see, the interests of the entire economy and people who say don't have a business, don't run a bank, but are just trying to, make their property tax payments and their retirement or something like that.
Cindy, thanks. Jack in Eagle River, hi.
Hi. My comment is I could care less who is actually appointed by Trump, because what your guest has shown us is that this is part of the system. We have a plutocracy, which is government of the rich, by the rich, and for the rich, period. End of discussion. He is just one of them. He's not going to do anything for the working class in this country. It's just a travesty, and both parties play to this. The system is corrupt and needs to be changed, and your guest, who works for Bloomberg News, is praising Mnuchin left and right for all the money he's made off the backs of the working class.
No, I don't think he's doing that. He's not praising Mnuchin for doing that. He's just reporting the story here. So I wouldn't read anything. He's just telling us a story here, what he's reporting on. But I'm sure there are a lot of people who feel just as Jack does, that, you know, both sides are in this. They're both guilty. And what about the working class? These are all billionaires. What in the world, you think they're going to help us? Come on.
Absolutely. And I think Trump tapped into that feeling that Washington is corrupt and out of touch in a plutocracy, I think, much more successfully than Hillary Clinton.
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I would say that if you were to look at the exit polls based on people who thought that the country was run by this cabal of insiders for the benefit of the rich, they very likely could have gone, they could have favored Trump by a healthy margin. And so, you know, it remains to be seen. I mean, he's brought in one of the most wealthy cabinets the most wealthy we've
right.
had in modern times. It's hard to make comparisons to earlier eras. But there's no question that he feels comfortable with bringing in people with a lot of money and often not much in terms of a record of public service. It remains to be seen if that's kind of a Nixon and China thing where they're the ones to fix the problem. I don't know.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. Zachary Miter, reporter for Bloomberg News since 2008, who wrote an in-depth profile of Steven Mnuchin for Bloomberg a few months ago that caught our attention. So we thought as he is facing... I guess the hearings are over for him, but there are some more forms that need to be filled out and to vote on him. He will, I think, without question, become the Treasury Secretary. We thought it would be worthwhile to find out more about him. So we'll take more phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network. Okay, we go back to phone calls. Mark in Delavan, our next caller for you. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Kathleen. What is the name of the gentleman from Bloomberg?
His name is Zachary.
Zachary, I'm really liking the show. I just wanted to add something, though. We're talking about presidents or administrations that have had somebody from Goldman Sachs in the Treasury, and you did not include Obama. Wasn't Timothy Geithner a Goldman Sachs person?
It's interesting. He actually wasn't. In fact, his career is almost entirely in the public sector. For some reason, that seems to have lodged in people's imagination.
It does,
many,
yes.
Many people have accused him of being a Goldman Sachs alumnus, even though he actually isn't.
Hmm.
And let's be clear. I mean, I don't think there were any Goldman Sachs folks in the Treasury Treasury Secretaries under Obama, but he drew heavily from people on Wall Street for top administration posts. It's not like somehow the big banks weren't represented with alumni in the Obama administration.
Uh-huh. Thanks, Mark. Let's go to Gail next in Fish Creek. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think with this history repeating itself, and what was lighted upon a couple of calls ago, is the merging of the parties. And Gore Vidal had written about that decades ago in one of his very powerful books about the U.S. and the turn of the times, where we're seeing that now. And it would be, I think, really difficult for Hillary to be in office at a time where that collective third power that is so to speak, no pun intended, trumped both parties, is actually taking over. I see that being globalization is still very powerful, and Agenda 21 is still very powerful locally, and it's called Vision 2030 globally. And even Saudi Arabia is involved in Vision 2030. So we have a lot more to look at rather than just Trump's tweets. We should all keep our eye on the bigger ball, and everyone should start looking for more information and not from the regular media, because that's part of the problem, too. They've been sleeping with them too long and dictated too long, and we're having that issue to take back the power of our government and eliminate some of the excesses that have been taking on and also take a look at the people empowering themselves and taking responsibility.
Okay. Thank you, Gail, very much for your call. Steve in Banbury. Hi.
Hi. In this nominee, we have a guy whose whole goal in his life has been to make a lot of money. And it seems to me then to put him in charge of the fiscal policy of the United States is an inherent conflict of interest. He doesn't have a public service background. He doesn't have a degree in economics. Instead, it's been all about him and making a lot of money. And doesn't that present just an inherent conflict of interest?
Zachary.
Well, in terms of his financials, I mean, because he's Treasury Secretary, he's going to be divesting most of the assets he has, stock and bonds and things like that that are left over from his time on Wall Street. So in terms of the kind of formal, like the actual assets he owns, he's going to be, required under the law to kind of take care of most of that. But I think what you're talking about is maybe this deeper concern that if you spend your whole life thinking like an investment banker or a Wall Street trader, it might be difficult to kind of, suddenly start thinking about serving the public as a whole. I think that's a tough question to answer. Other than just kind of looking at what policies he's proposing and who they would benefit and things like that.
And Zachary, on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.